Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, a little later in the program, we're going to talk to the CEO of Kidzania. Have you heard of Kidzania? Actually, they started in Mexico, and it's like, they're moving into a vacant Sears store. I think it's at Oakbrook in the mall, and they're these big sort of kids learning centers. They've been all over the world. I think there are 24 different locations, but not in the U.S. They're just opening a couple in the U.S. and one here in Oakbrook coming next year. So we'll talk to the CEO of Kidzania a little bit later. As I said, Max Temkin, one of the co-creators of Cards Against Humanity, will be in studio a little bit later in the program as well. But right now, Andrea Haines is here. She is the editor for Blue Sky Innovation in the Chicago Tribune. Andrea, welcome back.
Thanks, Steve.
All right, so we're going to talk to Max about the whole internet security thing, but that when it comes to innovation and fighting, that's been a big story this week.
Definitely has been a big story. So companies now reacting to it, and we will see what happens with that. I'm actually looking forward to hearing your conversation with Max.
Yeah, Max has kind of been making national news with his quirky threats.
Yes, people are pushing back. Definitely pushing back on the general idea that people could know everything about what we look at online.
And Comcast just said within the past hour, I think it was, that they will not sell this material. So we'll see how that goes. That's one of the things that is being covered in Blue Sky. But also, tell me about this. Is it called Swap Motors?
Yes.
Yep. So it's this. It's the idea is you've got a car, you want to sell it, and rather than maybe putting a sign in the car into your driveway or going from dealer to dealer, there's now a way to auction it off to other, not to other private buyers, right, but to other dealers.
Yeah, so it's giving you a way to sell your car. And it allows for, it's not just a platform. They also actually will send out a mechanic to look at your car, help validate the price, and then hopefully get you the best price you can get when you're selling a used car, which right. always feels like it's really hard, doesn't it? Especially if you're doing a trade-in or that kind of thing. I feel like it's always a little bit fraught.
Well, I mean, if you're selling your car for a trade-in, the idea is that the dealership needs to make money on it too.
Yep.
So they're not going to give you what you might get elsewhere. But I like this idea that you've got several dealers who are going to auction our bid on it then. So then if it is something that's really worthwhile, you figure you're not going to get really ripped off by going to one spot.
Yeah, and you kind of have like transparent fees, which, you know, some people might like. They charge $99 per transaction for the dealer. And then as the seller, which would be kind of you, the individual selling your car, they charge between $249 and $449, depending on the price of the
right.
car that
so
you're $250, selling.
That's not a
potentially
little...
not bad if you, you know, it's a chunk, but I guess if it drives the price up enough.
I sold my 73 you know. Red Pinto for $250.
Yeah.
So I think it would be a wash for me there.
I traded in my last car, and I'm still haunted by the gleam in the car salesman's eye, which makes me know that did not get a good enough price for it.
That's it. So this, you're a perfect example of how this might work for someone.
It definitely makes it tempting to at least consider selling it, I think.
All right. It's called Swap Motors, and they're up and running, right? I mean, they're just kind of getting
their
feet under
them. They are. They're newer. They just started in January, so they've only done about 20 cars so far, but they're about to kind of ramp up their marketing and, you know, get going.
Have you been invited to 1871's fifth birthday party?
I have not.
Oh, I don't know that they're having one.
It
I just thought
sad.
I'd ask.
Five no,
years.
I'm just
it's
kidding.
Kind of a. I'm surprised. I don't know how to make it to that date. I mean, it seems in some ways that they've been around forever.
It does. It seems like a long time. They predate Blue Sky. Blue Sky's 3.5, so they were around before Blue Sky was. But certainly, as business organizations, we've been covering them since they started and even before they started.
Right.
They've definitely evolved. They're bigger, bigger, bigger. And they have announced this week, when Howard Tolman addressed the City Club, that one of the new things they have coming is an Internet of Things incubator called the Chicago Connectory.
Okay, do that again, because I'm always asking people to explain what the Internet of Things is.
So this is the connected everything. This is your refrigerator's connected, your dishwasher's connected to the Internet. This idea of everything from wearables to the devices in our homes.
So this is the communication and all of that.
Smart. Exactly. Right. The communicating devices.
Bixby, as Samsung has introduced us to this week.
Exactly. Yep. Definitely things to imagine businesses growing up around that.
I was reading a story in Blue Sky and some statistics. Now they've got 500 startups working there, 200 graduate companies. They've created more than 8,000 jobs and attracted more than $200 million in investment.
These are their numbers right now. Yep.
Not too shabby.
Yeah, it's a great hub. I think that's a good word for it. You know, tech hub is kind of the shorthand we always use for it. It's a good place to showcase this whole idea of entrepreneurship and what Chicago's doing around it.
I think I was talking to the Inno guys. They come by on Mondays a few weeks ago, and they were talking about how Chicago has quite a gaming industry. And another story in Blue Sky is about this I don't know if it's a startup or exactly what you'd call it, but it's called I Need Diverse Games. And it's a woman who's raising money to try to get people into gaming, people of color, right? Or
exactly.
Women into gaming industry sessions so that they might be hired. Explain that one for me.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea because I think it is, and I don't think they would take offense at this. It's just a very small effort, but I think it's a very interesting one.
Yeah.
It's just a tiny, basically, nonprofit. And the idea is that to go to these gaming conventions where you might be going as a user, you might be going as a developer.
It's like $1,500,
$1,600
bucks.
But just to diversify the scene there, it can cost $1,600, one of them, to get a pass to go to this thing. So this woman, who is an African-American woman, going to these things and saying, like, I don't see anybody like me, but I'm really into gaming, is finding ways to help get people the money to go, even just as an attendee, not necessarily even as a developer or for job purposes, but just to diversify the scene at these things where these decisions get made.
Interesting. You guys cite a study from Pew that says Black respondents were more likely to have positive views about video games compared to whites or Hispanics. Whites tended not so much.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Pew hasn't been in my basement, apparently.
Yeah, really. You do think of more kind of white guys, right, as being
right.
The prototypical gamer, but there's gamers of all kinds.
Andrea Haynes, we'll see more at Blue Sky Innovation and ChicagoTribune.com.
Thanks, Steve. Yeah,
thanks.
For
have
sure.
A great weekend.
You too.
Listening to the Business Lunch on 720 WGNR. We all know about fake news. I mean, about the origin of fake news. It's a term that's kind of taken on a new meaning in the past few months. But originally, fake news were these items placed on social media, Facebook, Twitter, wherever, that spread. People made money by spreading false information. By the clicks, they got paid. How do you stop that? How do you stop a populace from being deliberately misinformed? That's one of the things that Naran Ramakrishnan is looking at. He's a professor at Virginia Tech University, and he joins us on a phone line now. Naran, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having me.
You know, it's interesting to me the idea that you're using science in a way to keep people from being fooled, because in a way the being fooled part is a very brain function, an education function, and yet you with algorithms and engineering can maybe avoid that. Explain that for me.
Yeah, that's a nice way you characterized it. So my students and I, we've been studying fake news, misinformation, and rumors on social media for the past several years. So what we are interested in is trying to find out how we can separate fake news from real news. Can we detect them early and how to counter them so you can limit the spread of misinformation?
Take me back a little bit then, because, you know, a lot of us were introduced to it during the election and in the campaign. You've been looking at it for years now. What did it look like 2 and 3 years ago? How was it used, and how did what were people fooled about, and how did people make money from it?
So I'll give an example from a couple of years back. I don't know if people made money from it, but this was during the heights of the Ebola crisis, and there were several rumors about the outbreak that were floating on social media. And if you listen to it today, they sound downright ridiculous. So, for instance, there was a rumor that Ebola could be airborne. There was one about the U.S. government having a patent on the Ebola virus.
Right, right.
And the new iPhone 6, which was new at the time, they thought people were getting infected by it, you know, to acquire Ebola. So I don't know if people made money out of it, but certainly there was a lot of concern about false information spreading during that time. And so the CDC did take to Twitter to dispel some of these rumors. But if you'd like to dispel these rumors, you've got to have the same network that the rumor spreaders were having so that you reach the same audience and can quell these misinformation campaigns.
It's interesting then you use Ebola as an example, because if I can take the virus, the Ebola virus, you treat these rumors, this fake news, as it's sort of a computer virus, and that's the approach you take to knocking it down. Explain that for me.
Exactly. So so we model the spread of rumors and fake news as an epidemic, as you said, not unlike a real disease. So when you're exposed to a virus as a human being, there's some chance that you're going to get infected by it. Similarly, when you're exposed to an idea, on social media, you have the choice of believing it or remaining a skeptic. If you believe it, you might reshare it or retweet it. If you're a skeptic, you likely ignore it. So what this does is you can think about controlling fake news very similar to how you might think about controlling disease spread. So what we ended up doing was to think about how you can design and release a counter contagion that can reach as many of the infected people. I mean infected in a metaphorical sense here, so that they're exposed to, you know, alternative viewpoints or the truth in some cases.
And have you done this, and has it worked?
So we haven't actively done a study like this, but we have observed this in action. So, for instance, we have cataloged fake news, instances of fake news on social media. And we have found, for instance, that some of them persist, some of them do not. And most of the time, or at least in some cases, when they do not persist, it's typically because there was a very good counter-contagion effect. There was early detection of these rumors, and there was early response by the, you know, concerned authorities.
And so what kind of response are we talking about? Is this sort of like fighting bots with bots, or is it something just like the CDC coming out very directly and saying, hey, what you're hearing about the iPhone 6 is silly?
That's true. So the CDC, you know, the CDC example was one where the authorities took to Twitter, but sometimes that's not sufficient. I don't know if you really need bots at the scale that some of these rumor mongers are using. But you certainly need to identify people who are influencers, who are central in your network, and make sure that they spread the correct information. So identifying who you should target so that they act as good spreaders of the truth is really key here.
So this isn't really a one-size-fits-all sort of fix. I mean, you're not going to turn on a program and refute fake news. What you're prescribing, in a way, doctor, is medication or a method of attack for each instance that comes up.
Yeah, this is difficult to you know, to generalize in practice. So, for instance, Facebook recently announced measures for users to flag content. That's a step in the right direction. But what I'm saying is you need the same tools that the rumor mongers have. You need to have a very similar content delivery platform. You need the same access to information spreaders. And you need the ability to detect and respond really quickly. So what I'm advocating is that you need to be vigilant, and you need to often counter these contagions much before they spread, very early on in the course of the epidemic, so to speak.
Naran Ramakrishnan is a professor of engineering at Virginia Tech University. Thanks very much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. Bye. It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, Max Temkin is on a phone line. He was one of the co-creators of the game Cards Against Humanity and so much more. And, well, Max, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Where are you exactly? Are we following you on the street here?
I'm making my way towards the studio. But, stuck in that wonderful... what do we got? 12:38 p.m. Chicago traffic.
Yeah, there's this weird thing right now. I don't know if you've seen it, but if you open up Google Maps, a Pac-Man game appears.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw that, but it just happened like a half hour ago or so. Anyway, I'm not kidding. But so there are so many different circles or ways for me to talk about what's going on with you this week. I'm not sure where to start. Let's go to. do you agree?
Yeah, we're having a busy week.
It's just a weird thing. All right, let's go to Congress, where they voted to repeal new privacy regulations that the Obama administration had put in place. Now, they hadn't taken effect yet, but the Congress voted to repeal them. And the idea was, under Obama, you would have these internet companies like Comcast, AT&T, and others would have been forbidden from selling my personal search engine history. You know, they couldn't do that. That was private. The Congress has voted to repeal that, and now they will be allowed to do that. And that sort of got you into action because you think that's a bad idea. Explain for me the steps then that you took.
Well, that first of all, I just want to commend your correct reporting of this story. It's a really boring, complicated technical issue, and it's widely misreported, but that is in fact exactly what's happened. So essentially, you know, we've known for many years that the internet service providers and cable companies, they will basically recognize that there's enormous value in all of the information of all of their users. So the websites you go to, the people you talk to online, what you're searching for, all that data. And they want to be able to sell that to advertisers so that advertisers can target you for ads. But of course, for a number of reasons, you know, people like myself who make a living on an open and free and private internet feel like that's really dangerous.
Max, let me interrupt you then, because telling people that, you know, I'm explaining it, and they said, well, wait a minute, when I click on something, let's say I click on, you know, an underwear ad, I can't escape that now anywhere I go. So that somehow that information is being shared. Now, is that just within Facebook, or how do you explain that?
Well, it's a whole complicated world of all of the different parties that want to follow you around online. But currently, you know, it is legal for third parties. Like, let's say I wanted to buy an ad on a website. You could be shown that ad, and I, as the advertiser, would be given an enormous amount of information about you, what kind of computer you're using, some of your, you know, what if you're on a phone, what sort of cell provider you have. And that data is then used by the advertisers to better target their advertising. And if it's on a network like Facebook, they get even more information, like what kind of, you know, what your hobbies are, what kind of things you look like on Facebook. But the one line in the sand that's pretty clear here is the internet service provider, the person who sees everything you do on the computer all the time. They know everything you search for on Google. They know every website you go to. They know every if you use Skype calling or VoIP calling, they know every person that you talk to. They are the central pipe that has all of your information. And as you said, it's been regulated. There's been very common sense limits on how much of that information they can publicly disclose or sell to advertisers. And this week we saw a really disappointing deregulation effort to make it legal to sell that information.
Now, Comcast just said this morning that they haven't sold that in the past and they will not in the future. Are you heartened by that?
Steve, let me ask you, like, do you trust what Comcast says in terms of protecting your personal information?
Yes, they're going to be at my house between 10 and 2 p.m.
I mean, right? It's like cable companies are the least trusted and least liked brands in the United States of America. So nobody trusts these companies to do what's in the interest of the consumer. And you're going to see this come to the front again, possibly in just a couple of weeks, in the fight over net neutrality, because we already know that after this victory, congressional Republicans are going to go after net neutrality. So, you know, the honest answer is nobody knows what's going to happen. I mean, maybe things won't be that bad. Maybe Comcast will do the right thing and put, you know, people before profit. But, like, I don't necessarily think they have, you know, any major, you know, publicly traded company has a great record of that, right? They have an obligation to make money for their shareholders, not protect my privacy.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I do take Comcast at their word, and if they said they're going to do that, I believe them. But so that's the serious part. Let's get to the silly part. Then you make a threat that you're going to buy the search engine history of every member of Congress and make it public. Of course, there's no real method or a way to do that. People take you uber seriously, and now they're ticked at you that you haven't done it yet.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, the message that this was sort of a joke that Cards Against Humanity put out, but with a serious intention behind it, which is, you know, in the sort of nightmare scenario where you can just go and buy someone's search history, you know, we've said publicly we'll go buy the search history of members of Congress and their staff and we'll post it online. Because, you know, one of the things that's so frustrating about this political climate is I don't feel like there's a lot of long-term thinking.
Right.
Like, I don't think Paul Ryan is necessarily, you know, thinking through. I think he's thinking, how do I keep things together today, right? How do I get this vote done today and keep these constituencies happy today? I don't think he's thinking in 5 years, is some idiot going to be able to buy my search history and embarrass me? So I hope that at least we can inspire people to ask that question of, like, do I want to live in a world where my personal information online is bought and sold in the marketplace? Because people, I mean, the things you ask to Google, it's incredibly, you know, I ask like the most intimate right. questions in my life to Google that I wouldn't want anyone to know.
I don't want anyone to know that I didn't know how to make a souffle until I asked.
Exactly.
All right. So that brings us to point C or maybe D of this story, in that there are other people now raising money from people to buy the search engine histories of members of Congress. And those, you kind of say, are probably a scam, or at least you should be worried of those.
Well, I'm a little suspect of them because, as I said, you know, this law hasn't even been signed by the president yet. There is this, it is, as far as I know, it's not legal to buy or sell this information at the moment. So these people are making, there are people out there. Listen, here's what it comes down to. A lot of people online and in the public are really upset about this. They don't want to imagine that it's legal for their most intimate details of their life to be sold in some sort of marketplace. Like, I don't want that to be true. And people want something to do. They're attracted to these people who say, well, I'm going to raise money and go intimidate congressmen or whatever. So I hope people think twice before they give their money to a crowdfunding campaign to do something like that. But I also do have, if it'd be helpful for your listeners,
sure.
I do have some sort of practical advice on what people can do to protect their internet privacy in the wake of this deregulation.
All right, we're running out of time, but go for it, Max.
All right. Well, I've got two things that people should look at installing on their, this is for a desktop computer, and these are browser extensions that you put in your browser, so like a Firefox or Chrome. They're both tools made by the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is a nonprofit dedicated to online privacy and your rights on the internet. The first tool is called HTTPS Everywhere, and this is basically a tool that once you install it, you never have to think about it or do anything, and it just quietly asks websites for an encrypted connection so that it makes it impossible for your ISP to spy on what you're doing. And the second tool is called Privacy Badger, and this is a tool that when, like you mentioned, Steve, when advertisers want a lot of personal information, Privacy Badger gets in the middle and denies them that information. And that's a tool that you can also put on your browser, and it just goes to work protecting your privacy. So those tools, again, are called HTTPS Everywhere and Privacy Badger, and you can go to EFF.org to learn more about how those tools work and support their work.
Check out EFF.org. Max, great to talk to you. Hope we can do it again real soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
All right, tip that cab driver, will you? You've been with him a long time. We'll see ya. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. It's 12:53. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, let's go play a little bit. Keith Rubenstein is on a phone line. He's the CEO of Kidzania. Have you heard of Kidzania? You probably will coming up, if not this year, in the years to come. Keith, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thanks for having me.
So let's just start with the plans, right? Kidzania is opening up in the mall at Oak Brook. Is it next year or the year after that?
That should be opening sometime towards the end of 2018.
Okay, so that's quite a build-out, which I think lends itself to the complexity of exactly what Kidzania is. Explain it for me.
So if you could imagine, Kidzania is a indoor city that's built for children to learn and role play about what it's like to be adults. So when I say that, if you could think that when a child is dropped off at Kidzania, their actual experience is being dropped off at an airport. And when they're at their airport, they come and they are issued a ticket, and then they go through security and they're given immigration documents, and then they go to human resources and they choose a job or jobs that they want to perform, and they are taught skills and they earn money that's in the currency of Kidzos, which is the currency of Kidzania, and they are immersed in this inspirational and aspirational experience where they're taking their skills that they're learning at school and they're applying to real life activities.
It started in Mexico, is that correct?
That's correct, in 1999.
And you've got, what, as I recall, like 20 or 24 other locations around the world?
That's correct. So it's been a very, very well-received, highly successful operation all over the world, and we're really excited to open it in and roll it out in across America.
And is Oak Brook going to be the first in the U.S. or among the first?
It'll be among the first, but probably the second. We're also opening a little earlier in 2018 in Frisco, Texas.
And so and I'm just trying to get my head around it then. Is this the sort of thing that parents will drop their kids off at, or something that parents will experience with their children? Explain that for me, Keith.
It's either or, but we encourage parents to allow the child to experience Kidzania on their own. But we have facilities for parents to utilize in terms of a lounge and restaurants, and they could also be part of the interaction in terms of being a part of the audience in the theatrical productions. But mostly what happens after the first time that the parent drops the child off, they go and they use the other amenities in the shopping mall.
Yeah, I get that. Okay, so, and that's one of the things. I mean, malls, we talk about that a lot on this show, how the big anchors are sort of going away, and what do you do with this space? This is an example of an innovative sort of use of an anchor location at a mall being used to, in a different way. Is that sort of, do you look to expand in that way around the country? Is that where you're looking at?
That's exactly correct, and we believe that we are a perfect solution for mall operators in terms of continually to activate their shopping malls with visitors. We'll have a million visitors a year come to our venues, and you know, think about the people after they drop their child off, they'll go and they'll eat lunch or dinner, or they'll go shopping, or they'll go to a movie, or whatever other amenities are provided by the shopping mall.
So you're not just taking up empty space, you're bringing people in.
I think so. That's exactly the case, and that's why I think it's an exciting opportunity for mall operators. And the reaction that we've gotten has been overwhelmingly positive.
Keith Rubenstein is the CEO of Kidzania, coming to Oak Brook a little bit later next year. Keith, thanks for joining us on the Business Lunch today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.